The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You know, I love your stuff. I love your work.
And, oh, thank you.
And I am the least, how do I put this? A country.
Rural.
I think that's a good way to put it.
Annie Dillard has been writing about nature and spirituality since the 1970s, when she won the Pulitzer Prize for Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. She hadn't yet turned 30. The book was a bestseller, but Dillard over time became a real writer's writer, revered for her dedication to the craft of writing, sentence by sentence by sentence. She's 70 now, and she's no longer writing. A collection of Dillard's work has just come out called The Abundance, Narrative Essays Old and New. In the last decade or so, your day is quite different from the decades before. You've retired from writing, and your creative energies have been poured into painting.
That's right.
I wonder what caused that decision. Did you feel that you were in some way diminishing as a writer?
Yeah, sure. I came into a room and saw a legal pad with my handwriting on it, and I read it because I always write by hand, and it was the beginning of a sentence, and I thought, what a promising beginning of a sentence. I wonder what in the world that was to have been about. I couldn't figure out the end of it from the beginning, and I thought, time to quit. You need a short-term memory.
So in other words, you were starting to feel that the prose that had been put on that yellow pad the day before was written by somebody mysterious, not you, that you're not able to carry the book around in your head in quite the same way as when you were 40.
Of course, you never carry the sentences around, but at least where you're going next.
Mm. Was that a devastating discovery? Was that very difficult?
No.
Really?
Well, we're here under conditions, and you either accept them or fight them, but the conditions aren't going to change at all. So you can either accept the conditions as they are or fight them and bitch about them all the time, but you're not going to change the conditions, so you might as well accept them.
I'm in the fighting and bitching about it stage of life.
I miss the sports. It is true. I really miss the sports. I'm down to ping pong.
Mm-hmm. Apparently you're a terrific ping pong player.
Yes, sir.
When you go back and you read Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, which is acknowledged as a classic by almost universally, when you go back and look at that early work, do you recognize the person that wrote it? Do you remember it clearly? Does it feel, I wrote that, or does it feel like somebody else?
Oh, I have to admit that I wrote that. It's as if you look at old pictures of yourself, photographs. Mm. Somebody called it recently my most conventional book, and that settled me down about it, because I've never thought it was any great shakes, especially compared to some of the others. But if it was the most conventional, of course it would have the most readers, and I will not resent the poor thing for that. The ones that I prize most and my fellow writers prize most, in nonfiction, there's a book called For the Time Being, and writers adore that book. All along, I've been trying to work toward a vision of where we are on this earth. What's here? How can we describe where we are? And that bites off a much bigger chunk than any other book of where we are.
What does it mean to keep your eyes open, or, as you say, to see truly?
In the world's religions, there is always room for people who have experiences, and one of them is that the veils of illusion are whipped away, and you see a different world. I have seen, actually, the chloroplasts streaming in leaves that are on a tree. I've seen it under the microscope, but actually to look at a tree and see something strange about the leaves.
And that's a vision of a kind?
Yes.
A spiritual vision of a kind?
Yes.
And how do you get access to that? Does that come with a little piece of paper or a pill? Or is this?
It's license, actually. Mm-hmm. You get a license from the divine. No, I have no idea.
You've said that you're spiritually promiscuous, which is a fantastic phrase. In religious terms, how did you grow up in terms of practice and organized religion?
I was raised in a very high church Presbyterian atmosphere. I went to our minister when I was about 16 and quit the church. I came home from school and the phone rang, and it was from the assistant minister. And my mother said, "Why would he be calling you?" And I said, "Well, probably because I quit the church." She said, "Why did you do that?" And she slid down the wall like Lucille Ball. It was hilarious. And the minister, when I went to see him, he said, "This is rather early of you to be quitting the church. I imagine you'll be back soon," which I thought was quite smart.
Annie, let's go to page 19 of the book, The Abundance, Narrative Essays Old and New. And we'd love to have you read this passage from Teaching a Stone to Talk.
Sure, I'll be happy to. I have said that I heard screams. I have since read that screaming with hysteria is a common reaction, even to expected total eclipses. People on all the hillsides, including, I think, myself, screamed when the black body of the moon detached from the sky and rolled over the sun. But something else was happening at that same instant, and it was this, I believe, that made us scream. The second before the sun went out, we saw a wall of dark shadow come speeding at us. We no sooner saw it than it was upon us like thunder. It roared up the valley. It slammed our hill and knocked us out. It was the monstrous, swift shadow cone of the moon. I have since read that this wave of shadow moves 1,800 miles an hour. Language can give no sense of this sort of speed. Seeing it, and knowing it was coming straight for you, was like feeling a slug of anesthetic shoot up your arm. If you think very fast, you may have time to think, soon it will hit my brain. Less than 2 minutes later, when the sun emerged, the trailing edge of the shadow cone sped away. It was as though an enormous, loping God in the sky had reached down and slapped the earth's face.
My God, that's an astonishing passage, not just of naturalist writing, but also it's as horrifying as anything in Mary Shelley or Bram Stoker. Tell me a little bit about how a passage of writing like this gets accomplished.
Mm-hmm. I settled down to describe the eclipse, just trying to mess with it narratively. And boy, it was a mess. The whole thing took less than 2 minutes. And everything happened at once. And you can't keep a reader. Reading occupies time. It's a temporal art in the way that the visual arts are not. It takes time to happen. So I was writing. This happened, and then at the next second, this happened, and then simultaneously, this was happening. It was a mess because the poor reader was reading on, but stuck at that same instant. And in narrative, you want to keep the reader moving along, and God knows the reader wants to move along. So I decided to tell it over and over again, the exact same eclipse, beginning, middle, and end, from various levels of consciousness, to go a little deeper every time. The idea is to try to reproduce, to invoke in the reader one's own sensations, not to describe them, but to reproduce them. Not that I gave anyone the impression of having seen a total eclipse, but I did my level best.
Did you have a sense of mission when you began writing, to wake people up?
My mission was to write a book.
Yeah.
I was a poet, but could I write prose? I liked the complexity of prose rhythms. I liked that you could be logical or analytical in prose, that you could quote a great deal and explain a great deal of what was going on. Poetry doesn't lend itself to that, but prose does.
Did it matter to you about the breadth of audience that you could achieve as
Good
a prose writer?
Heavens, no. No, of course not. You have to understand, I was just a housewife in Virginia who wrote poetry. And then I was a housewife who wrote a book of prose. I thought I was addressing the book to maybe 9 monks. And in fact, a great many monks did read it. But that's because a great many other people read it. And that was in turn because on the Pulitzer Prize Committee that year, there was a South African named John Barkham with an H. And he, as a boy in South Africa, had read Laurens Vanderpost, who is just a beautiful writer. I've read him too. And he liked the book Pilgrim at Tinker Creek because it reminded him of Laurens Vanderpost. That's because all nature writers are pretty much alike. So he lobbied to give it the Pulitzer Prize. It was just a fluke. It could have been anybody at all, but it happened to have been John Barkham.
And the Pulitzer Prize did something for you in that way, that sometimes prizes have no effect whatsoever. The Pulitzer Prize affected your writing life how?
It made it easier to publish what I wrote subsequently, as well as, of course, making me self-conscious about what I wrote subsequently. Mm. Updike wrote about, who was the head of the New York Book Review for so many years?
John Leonard or the New York Times Book Review or the
Leonard,
New York?
Leonard. And he, John Updike, said that the bane of his life was that he couldn't write a sentence without imagining John Leonard's waxing sarcastic about it.
That kind of thing got in your head as a young writer?
Of course it did, but I got over it.
I know you move around the country during the course of a year. You're in Key West, you're in Virginia, and in Cape Cod. And in all three places, you're in extremely beautiful, natural settings, all of which are resonant each in their own way. And I wonder how getting older changes your relation, if at all, to the natural world.
You're more familiar with the stuff around you, the vegetation, that is, and the light, and the color. But mostly the vegetation fills your picture of what life on Earth is like. Here in Virginia, we live in a national forest. My husband lives in a cabin, and about 10 yards away, I have a shack. And I can see the stars at night as I go to bed. It's a national forest.
Mm.
there are no lights, and in whichever of four directions I look out, there's the beautiful world.
Annie, thank you.
Well, thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
Annie Dillard. The new collection of her work is called The Abundance.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.